This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
District of Conservation is sponsored by CFACT. To learn more about our sponsor, head over to cfact.org. Thank you so much for listening. Welcome to District of Conservation. I am your host, Gabriella Hoffman. This podcast offers a sober examination into all things hunting, fishing, shooting sports, energy, environment, and the public policy surrounding it. And this podcast also specializes in original interviews that you won't hear elsewhere. Here's what I have for you today. I'm delighted to have return guest to the program, Captain Dylan Hubbard of Hubbard's Marina in southwestern Florida, to talk about a really positive update concerning the Commerce Department vessel speed rule and some other trending issues, one concerning manatees being relisted with greater scrutiny under the Endangered Species Act and some other Gulf of Mexico related fishing regulations. Dylan, good to have you back on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it and look forward to chatting today about all these issues in the Gulf of Mexico.
So our little podcast kind of spurred greater awareness. You were able to appear on Fox Business, Fox News Channel Primetime with Jesse Waters to talk about this issue. Would you say that exposure, a little help from our podcast here, and maybe some other related reporting, did that really help kind of make the decision? And also with the marine manufacturers and others, there were many stakeholders involved. But I think you kind of being the spokesperson for opposing this Gulf of Mexico Rice's Whale speed rule perhaps invited the department to rescind the vessel speed rule. And that just took place, you informed me, I think it was the weekend before Halloween, a few days before Halloween. So break that down for us and talk about what this victory looks like and if we can really pause or still have to be worried about this potentially being adopted.
Yeah, I think there's still a grave concern there. I think basically the big point of the agency delaying any rulemaking based on the petition was, hey, we don't have enough information to support the rule or the petition. So I think it's not necessarily the agency saying, hey, we're not going to make a rule like this. I think it's the agency saying, we're not going to make a rule like this at this time. Let us get some more research done. So that's a big concern. I think there's still a lot to watch in the Gulf of Mexico concerning the Rice's Whales. And I think there's, it's definitely not a time where you can dismiss that as, hey, we won. Because the agencies, the associations, the organizations behind the petition aren't going to settle for losing. And the agency is not going to sit idly by on that ESA-listed species. They're going to continue to, they designated the critical habitat area. Now they're pouring a lot of money into researching the biomass of the species and the health of the population and some more information on it. And they're look at what's happening on the East Coast and up and down the
Atlantic,
south.
Yeah,
the Atlantic coast with the right whale. They've already moved forward with rulemaking, but that whale is definitely a lot different from the Rice's Whale and the fact that there's a lot more population. They have a lot more research. They're a lot more further along in the process with the right whale compared to the Rice's Whale. In the Gulf of Mexico, they don't have as much information. They don't know the population size, and they really don't know. I mean, the last doc assessment said, the scientists said in black and white, they don't know if the population can be recovered. So that's a lot of the question that's up in the air right now is exactly where does the critical habitat need to go? One concerning thing that I've seen adopted was they were petitioning this speed limit zone. The oil and gas industry actually voluntarily accepted the speed limit in this zone. I don't know if that was really well covered. I didn't see it really publicized anywhere.
First time hearing of it.
That's what I've heard from some inside sources, that the oil and gas industry is actually working with the petitioners and adopting that speed limit in that zone to try to squelch and appease some of that concern. So hopefully that gave me a little bit of positive feeling. Like if the oil and gas industry is willing to give it up and kind of bend over to the will of the petitioners, then perhaps maybe they won't push it any further, because they should, I mean, logic would dictate the recreational boating industry isn't the one that they're concerned with. It's really the oil and gas industry and the big ships and the transit vessels. And it's hard to get foreign flag vessels to abide by our laws anyway. So really the oil and gas industry is really the only people they would be able to get to enforce this rule upon. So if they're voluntarily willing to take the rule, that'll take a lot of burden off our industry. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I still think they'll try to lump recreational with commercial. They always conflate the two. And I still think, and like we talked about before, I still think there are ways for the two types of fishing industries to work together, even with our differences. You know, I've been able to align with them on other issues, even though I come from more of a recreational background. But I saw that in this moment that they were able to come together for this. But concerning whales, even the right whale, there's a lot of threats to it, of course, but I don't see them yet. But Congress has said, like, hey, we have the ability to help fund research, but they haven't seen cooperation from Commerce yet in terms of doing that. So I think they're also scapegoating the North Atlantic right whale too. And it's in a really perilous situation. Absolutely. But they continue to blame, much like they were with you guys, blaming recreational and commercial, even though it's the same risk entailed. The Marine Mammal Protection Act, the ESA, nobody wants to strike a whale intentionally because there are a lot of consequences that come with that. And why would they want to do that? The whale is significantly larger than most of these vessels, especially recreational. So the whale could cause untold damage and all that. So everyone knows what entails with clashes with whales. I don't see yet a seriousness with wanting to monitor whale health. And then they're endorsing projects that actually could worsen the whale's plight. So to me, it's like they're wanting to scapegoat recreationists because they have nothing else to say. They just kind of invented out of thin air. So you're right. We do have to monitor, especially on the Atlantic side, and still keep a watch on what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico, because they'll find a way to scapegoat the recreational boaters and anglers. And that's why I think the marine manufacturers and recreational interests came together and said, yes, we want to be partners in, and we are partners in monitoring whales, and we need to be, and excluding us by penalizing us doesn't help the whale nor us. So yeah. I like that they were forcing that. And maybe the administration listened here for a time, even momentary, but you never know. They could still work with these petitioners, to try to find a workaround. That's usually how these kind of preservationists work. But more relatedly, we're coming at the heels of the 50th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act being enacted. You had told me that this administration is looking to do something, perhaps relist with more stringent protections, manatees, especially a Florida strain. And you had mentioned before we went on air that the population is actually booming. So a listing, a more strenuous listing would actually inhibit recovery efforts and potential delisting efforts. And delisting, like my listeners know, and you and your folks know, doesn't always mean that decimation of a species will happen. It just means maybe states will have management over this particular species that has been determined to be recovered. So what is happening? What is going on? And talk about the manatee numbers and what this proposal would potentially do.
Well, I mean, the manatee issue in the state of Florida, I think it needs to be, I think I don't want to come across as not supporting the manatee population, because I think the manatee population in Florida is a great example of a case study of a bigger societal problem that we have in a lot of these species, whether it's the manatee or the black bear or charismatic megafauna in general. I mean, Florida spent $27 million last year buying lettuce to feed these animals because their population is at such a huge, massive point that there's so many species or so many animals, there's not enough estuary and environment to support them, and there's not enough food in the environment. So they're literally dying at an increased rate. The mortality, they're experiencing an unusual mortality event, much like the right whale is experiencing. And people are blaming the unusual mortality event on the fact that there's less seagrass in the region. And in my opinion, I think it has a lot to do with the water quality, and there's just so many more manatees than we've ever had before. I mean, manatees were listed when there was a population was around 1,000 manatees. It was like 1,300. Now we're up over 85,000 or 8,500 manatees. So the population is literally eight times the size. It was delisted in 2017. And the population is booming to the point where there's not enough food in the environment. And we're spending almost $30 million a year to feed these animals because there's not enough population or not enough food in the environment to support the population size. So one could argue the population has reached carrying capacity and there's not enough estuary and environment to support the numbers of individuals already in the environment. Or the flip side of it is the environment isn't healthy enough to support the number of individuals that are in the environment. For example, the water quality issues that we see across the estuarine environments on the West Coast and Southwest Coast of Florida through red tide events and other harmful algal blooms could potentially be impacting the seagrass population to the point where it's not allowing the manatees to proliferate and feed effectively. I mean, look at the IRL, the Indian River Lagoon system. It's hugely devastated with seagrass loss, and that's where they're spending a lot of money and a lot of time trying to feed these manatees because they don't have food to eat. So there's definitely a bigger picture at play in the fact that either we need to have a conversation about carrying capacity or we need to have a real conversation about these seagrass losses that we're experiencing at historic levels on the east and west coast of Florida due to water quality events that are still really out of control. And it's something that is kind of a systemic issue that we need to kind of embrace. I think a hard look at a smart growth plan and really reevaluating our living shorelines and investing in living shorelines. What's comical to me is if you want to buy waterfront property in Florida, you can go buy waterfront property in Florida if you got the money. And in order to build a dock on that waterfront property, you got to go through some steps with DEP and you got to pay to have this study done. And if you can shade an area, they'll let you come in and they'll let you build a dock. They should not only let you build a dock, but then they should then encourage or incentivize homeowners to rebuild living shorelines. If you're going to harden a seawall by building a seawall and building a dock, they should allow you to put benthic and surface structure there that's going to encourage growth and water filtration. I mean, there's oyster reefs that are floating, suspended, and then you could put benthic, meaning bottom-oriented oyster reefs there too. And the more oysters and growth and seagrass that you're promoting growing on that structure is going to filter more water, clean the environment, and help promote living shorelines. And no one uses the water underneath their dock. If you have a dock, you use the water on either side or in front or behind the dock for your boats and for your water recreation. Underneath your dock, no one goes there. So let's put some big oyster reefs under there. Let's encourage oyster growth, clam growth, barnacle growth, seagrass growth, and let's encourage water filtration along our coastlines. I think that coupled with a smart growth plan, making sure that we don't have septic use up and down our coastlines or along our interior areas, I think is all really, really smart plans in the long-term health of Florida ecosystems and marine environments.
I don't think you have an anti-manatee position. It sounds very much you care about wanting to accommodate a growing population of them. And this is what happens, as you very well know and our listeners know, when rulemaking happens. It doesn't account for the numbers. It doesn't account for the situation on the ground. And they just put a blanket statement regulation saying, we're putting more protections. But those protections aren't really helping the manatee, in this case, to proliferate more. It seems like this will inhibit and disincentivize, let's say, Floridians from wanting to create habitat or being incentivized to create, let's say, more habitat for them or feeding sources of that sort. To me, it doesn't seem like the proposed rule that you're talking about would invite kind of the solutions you're advocating for.
It ultimately it would cut those solutions off because once you release manatees, then everything becomes more conflated. There's more bureaucracy. There's more red tape. And everything becomes more difficult to navigate. Whereas right now, I mean, it could be really, really easy. Look at, for example, AstroTurf. In some municipalities, it's literally illegal for you to replace your grass with some really nice looking artificial turf because it's against county code. And it's silly. I mean, I think we should be incentivizing coastal homeowners to replace their grass with this artificial turf. Some of this stuff looks better than normal grass. You don't have to water it. You don't have to fertilize it. Now you're cutting a huge amount of nutrients from the system and you're not using as much water, which is relieving the pressure on our water quality or our water table, which we have a huge problem with in the state of Florida. And you're just really improving the overall health of the ecosystem. And instead of incentivizing that, we're actually penalizing people for trying to do this. And to me, it's really, really simple. If you look at the math on some of that artificial turf, if you live in the home for 5 to 7 years, it pays for itself to do that because you don't have to water it. You don't have to maintain it. And a lot of these coastal homes in areas that it is not against the law is already doing that for that reason. But if you made that some sort of incentive with like a tax break or something and made it cheaper for homeowners along the coastlines to do that, I mean, I travel the intercoastal waterway a lot and I'm constantly seeing grass clippings.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Being sprayed into the water, and that adds to detritus, that adds to nutrient loading in the systems, and you're constantly seeing people, they want green grass in their backyard, so they're gonna eventually pay someone to go out there and fertilize it or fertilize it themselves. And being right on the coastline, that fertilizer goes right in the water and fuels harmful algal blooms. So if there was ways that we can incentivize living shorelines and incentivize the use of artificial turf on along our coastlines, we're cutting out a huge number of nutrients into our systems and really improving the overall health of Florida. And I think that's something that we just need to kind of change the thinking and change the culture on and slowly work towards that kind of solution. Because as we improve water quality, seagrass goes up, and then the manatee population can support a larger number of individuals.
I know Florida gladesmen like yourself and all of you in the conservation space, Travis, Mike, and others, talk about these issues really well. Have you guys had conversations with anyone on the federal side? Because it seems like there's sometimes a disconnect, and even sometimes with your state as well, because these seem like workable solutions that everyone, even outside of Florida, would be totally on board with. But it doesn't seem like there are listening sessions to these recommendations. They just adopt these rules. They go unchallenged and there's really no stakeholder input. But have you guys been forcing conversations with the federal rulemakers who are deciding this rule?
So don't put me in the same class as Travis and Mike. Those guys are much more advanced and experienced than I am. I'm learning the ropes of this system myself. And I think guys like that set a great example of not only being gladesmen and conservationists, but they're also connected and they know how to get their message heard at a higher level. I'm not there yet, so I'm open to suggestions because I think there is a lot of good solutions at the ground level. And I think a lot of good ideas can come from fishermen, from outdoor enthusiasts like myself, but we just struggle. I mean, last night I was at a deep sea fishing club doing a fishing conversation. We're talking about fishery science and management. And they had a lot of good ideas, but they were begging me, like, how do we get these ideas heard? And there's really not a good path forward to talking about this and to getting those ideas heard. And one of the big problems that we have is, like, for example, the fact that fishery science is lacking so behind management. And even if we had $1 billion for fishery science tomorrow, we had the best, most informed management ever, the number of enforcement officers on the water is a joke. They do a great job, the ones we have, and enforcement is awesome. It's just there's a huge lack in number of enforcement officers. And the problem, everybody agrees this is a problem, but no one in the fisheries management space can go lobby Congress, and NOAA staff can't talk about appropriations. So you're stuck in this feedback loop of the council recognizes the problem, but they can't do anything about it. NOAA knows there's a problem, but they can't do anything about it. The Southeast Fisheries Science Center knows there's a problem, but they can't do anything about it. So is law enforcement. So it's left up to fishermen who have no idea how to be involved in the process to go out there and lobby Congress for more funding for science and management and ultimately enforcement. And none of us know how to do it really well. So I think that's another big problem that we need to work towards as well.
I think that's a common problem anywhere across the country. I hear about this in the Mid-Atlantic for coordination. Out west, it's always a big hurdle. You hear this in the Pacific Northwest, where they have a lot of challenges to wildlife management. I think it's more perilous than you guys, because they actually have people as commissioners who don't like the hunting and fishing lifestyle, and they're working against them in that grain. So you guys are a little better off. But yes, you do have to deal with a lot of different factors at play. But more related to our conversation, you were mentioning before we went online that there were some more issues pertaining to fisheries that you think my listeners should be aware of concerning the grouper and other stuff. Because I know and I recall you look at like kind of trends of what happens with fisheries policy. Sometimes when there are a little more preservationist environmentalists in charge in the White House and in different agencies, you see constraints placed on recreational fishing. The red snapper days have been shortened. There's fewer opportunities to do recreational fishing, especially in your backyard. So what are the other policy areas you'd like to discuss or updates that you want to update?
Oh, man. Well, I am severely frustrated today. Specifically, they just released the wave 4 data from MREP FES showing that we have literally more than doubled the year-to-date landings for red grouper in 19 days. So essentially what happened was we were looking at the landings from January 1st through the end of June. So the first 6 months of the year showed that we had landed about 62% of the quota for red grouper. So the season closed July 19th. So the first 6 months of the year, January 1st through June 30th, were already reported 62%. And we only had 19 more days left until the end of July 19th. So we're all sitting here thinking, all right, when this data comes out, we're probably going to have some leftovers. We're probably going to be able to reopen the red grouper fishery and have some more days. We're all excited about that, looking forward to that. Well, they just released the data and showed that in 19 days, we more than doubled the year-to-date landings. And now they're showing we landed 130% of the quota and went 30% over. So this is the third year in a row the recreational sector has overfished red grouper. And with that comes the accountability measures from the MSA that doesn't allow us to increase the catch level for red grouper. And it's extremely frustrating because the fishermen are being punished for the federal lack of ability to manage a fishery. It's absolutely heinous that we are being punished for the inability of management to close the fishery. I mean, essentially, it's not our fault that we fish the season when the season is open. If the season is open, we're going to go fishing. If the season is closed, we're not going to go fishing. So, A, it's frustrating that we're being penalized for overfishing when it's really the fact that the season was left open and NOAA's inability to project the season. And then B, how in the world in 19 days did we land more than double of our year-to-date landings? I mean, the math isn't mathing. I'm not a mathematician, but I mean, that does not add up. And logic dictates that something's wrong. And the fact that they're just sitting there saying, yep, we double-checked this. We QAQC'd this data. It's good to go. It's laughable, and it's frustrating. It's ultimately a spit in the face to the recreational fishery in general, and also the commercial fishermen, because they're held to a higher standard and they're held within the quota, and the recreational sector is overfished 3 years in a row now. And now everybody's being punished because this is a cyclical fishery and we're on a cyclical upswing, and we're seeing more and more fish at a larger average size So the fishery is showing all the signs of becoming healthier, but they can't increase the catch levels because MSA dictates you have to end overfishing. And if they go and say, well, the fishery is healthy, that's why they're hitting the quota, so we need to increase the catch level to end overfishing, they can't do that. And they'll get sued by environmental groups. So it's really frustrating. We're just caught in this feedback loop of never ending, hitting our head against the wall of, well, we know the fishery's healthy, we've got to increase the catch level, but we can't because NOAA is failing to do their job and failing to properly project the season and failing to prevent the overfishing by the recreational sector. And on one side, you could say that. And the other side, you could say, in my opinion, my tinfoil hat's coming out a little bit when I look at these numbers, because the numbers aren't adding up. Someone needs to answer the question on how in the world could we jump from 62% on June 30th to July 19th, 19 days later, jump to 130%. That does not make sense. That does not add up. So either NOAA's failing to do their job or someone's failing to add up the numbers right.
Yeah, they always put out sometimes questionable numbers. I think they often don't lean on science. They're just finding some numbers, say, oh my gosh, we saw this and this is worrisome, and therefore we have to change, you know, allotments and change the season. So it seems to me they're guided on reaction. And this is a common thread across other policies they've done. They did this for the vessel speed rule. They're doing it for other rules. Other agencies are doing this as well. They take little information or maybe an isolated case, maybe inflate the numbers or maybe have wrong math, kind of wrong input on in terms of the real math. And then they take and run that statistic, which could be challenged and tested, and say like, oh my God, this is what it is. So to me, it seems like they're bungling the numbers. It's not conspiratorial. We see this happening in other agencies too, because they just need something to run with to say, these closures are justified. This action is justified. So you're not crazy to think that like it is verifiable in some of their actions. You can make a case for that. Dylan, why don't we close out with talking about your business? How's business going? I know there's a lot of different factors at play. People are obviously pinching their budgets, being a little more careful. But are you guys staying busy with recreational fishing trips and offshore trips, even with all of this going on?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing all right from a business aspect. We're blessed to be a longstanding family business that's been in operation now for nearly 100 years. This year, we were voted the number one charter fishing company in the entire country by USA Today. So we're blessed to be in a position that we're in, and blessed to have a really great team and a really great group around us and a really great group of guests that continue to come back and patronize our family business. So as a whole, in our company, we're doing well. As an industry, we're struggling. We're struggling bad. I mean, our industry is anywhere from 15 to 25% down on average. A lot of the small operators, the mom and pops, are going out of business. A lot of new businesses are being pushed out. I mean, it's really sad what's happened this year to our industry with shortened seasons, restricted access, weather, and then just the limiting of seasons and the early closures and the failure to project proper season lengths, the early closure of gags, the early closure of red grouper, the shortened season for amberjack, the everything has just really put a burden on our charter industry. And travel and tourism as a whole is seeing a huge impact from inflation and rising costs of goods sold. The only travel and tourism industry that's really succeeding right now is the cruise industry. The cruise industry is flourishing because they have their all-inclusive option, right? So your small family of four can budget and know once they get on the cruise ship, they're not really going to spend a lot of money. Whereas if you come on a trip with your family to the beach right now in Central West Florida and Madeira Beach, where we're located, the hotel costs more, the restaurant costs more, the taxi ride costs more, everything costs more. So it makes it really difficult for a small family to budget. And the recreational piece of their vacation, the fishing trip, the dolphin tour, the shelling trip that they do with us at Hubbard's Marina, has all been kind of cut back a little bit. So we're seeing a lot of families that would come and do a half-day trip and a dolphin tour and a sunset cruise and an island trip. They might come out and only do one trip with us or perhaps only spend one day out at the beach. So we've definitely seen a decline in tourism numbers and a decline in overall headcount. But we're just trying to maximize what we can by diversifying and working together as a region to try to bring as many people as we can to our beautiful slice of paradise. But definitely the travel and tourism industry is suffering.
I've seen that here in Virginia too, even post-COVID, especially with inflation, rising gas prices, because boats rely on fuel, obviously, to chart and to operate. And yeah, with fuel prices going up and people pinching their pennies and being really judicious about what they spend, of course, it's a very big concern for operators, large and small like yourself. So it's not isolated. Unfortunately, we're seeing this all across the country. But I know the industry is very resilient. We've seen you guys come out of economic upturns and downturns before. And by having guests like you on the show, we're trying to showcase the importance of maintaining these family-owned and operated business, because you guys contribute a lot to the fabric of the country. You pay dues to conservation with all the monies generated through purchases and licenses. And so we will continue to drum that here on the show. And we are very always excited to have you back, guests like you back on the program, Dylan. So anytime you want to come back on, share an update, we welcome it. And tell everyone where they can follow you and connect with your business.
Well, you can check us out, hubbardsmarina.com. Look us up, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat, TikTok, Twitter, all that good stuff. Just look up Hubbard's Marina and catch us Sunday night. We do a show every Sunday night at 7:30 p.m. to talk about fishing and what's going on in the fishery. And hopefully we'll see you out in the water. And come find out why we're the number one fishing charter in the entire country. And don't forget, if you're too busy to go fishing, you're just too darn busy.
I would love to fish with you guys. We talked about this before. I hope I can come down to the region. We can hit the water maybe sometime in the next year or two with my schedule being so busy with my new job. But Dylan, thank you again for coming on the program. This is very informative. I know my listeners, even those outside of the Gulf of Mexico region, will be really attuned to this and follow this policy more. Maybe tell their friends in Florida to care about these issues and really kind of share the message. So we appreciate you coming back on. Thank you so much.
Anytime. Thank you. You have a great day.
Thanks for listening to District of Conservation. If you enjoyed what you heard today, go leave us some reviews on Apple and Spotify or wherever podcasts are played. Your feedback will help us reach more people, and I love to know what is on your mind after each episode. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to never miss a beat or a guest announcement, because that is our way of updating all of you listeners. And we have just hit 1,000 followers on Instagram for the podcast account. Thank you very much. And if you have any guest suggestions or topics you want to hear on the show, I am all ears. I would love to hear your feedback there. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.